Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a crime and mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, joined as always by our consigliere, our legal expert, our partner in crime, our co-host, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, what's happening? How are you? Always good to talk to you. Another week, another sit down. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great, brother. It's looking forward to getting into today's topic. I think this is one that a lot of people will have some familiarity with, but we'll be interested to learn some of the details of.
Yeah, and you know, Blackjack kind of alluded to it. We're going to get right to the show because we got a great one today. We're going to talk about Jimmy Burke. And I think one thing needs to be said right out of the gate about Jimmy Burke, you can make the case, and I don't even know if there's a case to make on anyone else. Jimmy Burke is the most successful non-Italian mobster of all time. It's that simple. Not only did he amass a ton of wealth, but he amassed a ton of power. He amassed a ton of respect. He was a cold, calculated individual who, killed. And again, we relate this to the movie Goodfellas. Obviously, if you know anything about the movie, you know Jimmy Conway. Jimmy Conway is based on Jimmy Burke. All those people are real. Everyone from Paul Cicero, who was Paul Vario, Henry Hill, who had the same name. They were all involved. Tommy DeSimone, all those guys were involved. And we're really going to talk about them all today with really concentration into Jimmy Burke. You know, it's really crazy how powerful Jimmy Burke was, some of the schemes he was able to pull off in his career, not only the Lufthansa heist, but the point shaving scandal at Boston College. We'll get into the Billy Bat situation, which was a real event that did actually happen. And we'll kind of get into some of the myths of the movie and what was true and what wasn't. And, you know, Blackjack, in fact, if you watch the movie and you know anything about Burke, a lot of Burke's teenage years were very reminiscent of how they portrayed Henry Hill. Not a lot's known about Henry Hill, really, up until he met Jimmy Burke. But we'll kind of get into all that, the main players, the people involved, you know, the big heist that went down and some other really interesting things. You know, it's funny, Blackjack, a quote by Jimmy Burke right out of the start. He was asked about his life and you know, regrets that he had and what he would have did wrong. And I guess the person that asked him this didn't expect him to respond, but he was quoted as saying one time this. He said, "My downfall was I was too greedy, too much money, too much heat." And, you know, you can be as secret and as, you know, paranoid as you want, but at the end of the day, the ultimate equalizer, Blackjack, is money. And Jimmy Burke, there were just too many folks involved, and really a fascinating guy. You'd agree. I mean, a lot of famous and powerful Italian guys, but you can't ever be made if you're not Italian. And, you know, Jimmy Burke was quite powerful, which we'll get into.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can say, and you kind of touched on it, that he was a made man without the title, right? I mean, he had every bit of power, influence, sway, control, success. I mean, he was everything that a made man was without having that title, which is not an easy thing to get. I mean, part of the deal with the mafia is it is an insular organization, right? I mean, that's the main gateway to entry. And so for him to be kind of embraced the way he was is incredibly rare and is a testament to him.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, we'll get into the biography, we'll get into the different players, we'll get into the stories that obviously relate to Goodfellas. But I think it's important to dispose of certain myths about the movie. Look, every movie can't be exactly true. But look, people have asked my opinion on the movie. I think it's very good. It's one of the best mob movies ever. Mm-hmm. Do I like the fact that they kind of glom on to Henry Hill like he was some, you know, boss, basically? No. I mean, if you know Henry Hill, he was an associate. That was all he was. He was a lackey, basically. He was, you know, a guy that, you know, created schemes. He definitely was a tough guy and did things, but you know, the movie that should be made is about Jimmy Burke. Jimmy Burke was really the architect of all this stuff. Let's get into it. Jimmy Burke on the sit down. As always, we are powered by StableDuel. Make sure you go checking out StableDuel. It's horse racing season, folks. We got the Kentucky Derby just happened. The Preakness at Pimlico just happened. We've got the Belmont Stakes here in a few weeks. And then it's summer horse racing, you know, all the great tracks. Make sure you're going and checking out StableDuel, one of the big and up-and-coming apps. You're probably seeing it everywhere if you're moving around in the sports betting community or the sports community. StableDuel is the next big thing. You know, they have fantasy for football and basketball and baseball. Why not a horse racing app for fantasy? And I would go check it out. It's a great way to make some coin. You don't have to go and necessarily deposit money on a horse racing account to make money. Go check out StableDuel. All right, Blackjack, let's jump into it. Jimmy Burke, James Burke, was born Blackjack James Conway. That's where they got the name from. That's where they called him in the movie. He was actually born James Conway in the Bronx, New York, on July 5th, 1931, basically just after the Depression, early 30s. The country was kind of trying to create itself again. There were still droves of immigrants coming into this country from Europe. Jimmy was born to his mother, Jane Conway. Jane Conway was a rough woman. She was from Ireland. She was a prostitute. She was destitute. She didn't have much. He doesn't know his father. His father, James, they didn't identify until later in his life. And he wasn't a part of his life. Neither was his mom. At age two, she basically left Jimmy on the porch of a foster home and basically abandoned him. Jimmy Burke had, I think, more of one of the sadder childhoods in mob history, as far as, you know, a lot of these guys have a father or even a good family. Some are connected to the mob, some aren't. Right. But it's rare where you don't see both parents involved. I know John Gotti, he didn't have a great father figure. He did have a mom, though, and she was very important. But it's rare, Blackjack, to see, you know, most people have at least one parent. Jimmy Burke's the only mob guy that I'm familiar with that didn't have both parents growing up. Pretty sad.
Yeah, it's really sad. And, you know, I think there's a certain amount of logic behind it, right? Like, yeah. I think if you grow up without either parent in your life, I mean, your father, you never knew who he was. Your mother literally abandoned you on a doorstep. I mean, it's some of the most god-awful shit you can imagine. I think that, you know, I don't know that you're drawn to the concept of family at that point. You kind of, I think you're almost a lone wolf in the world, you know? So it's, yeah, I think it goes to show you that, yes, a lot of the people who get involved in the mafia do generally come from larger, strong families.
Yeah. And, you know, really for the next 10 years, basically from 2 years old up until his early teens, Jimmy Burke had a rough life. He was abused mentally, physically, sexually, emotionally. He was basically at a Roman Catholic orphanage, and you know, he had a lot of trauma, a lot of things going on that a little kid shouldn't have to deal with and see and be a part of. And, you know, he just never really had anyone that cared about him. And as you said, you know, it's tough to grow up in a situation like that and expect to come out not fucked up, basically. When he was 13, he was actually adopted by two people. And basically one day, you know, they weren't great people. One day, Jimmy's riding around with his foster father. And he does something to, you know, I'm sure you, when you're a kid, remember this. I remember one or two times where I did something and my dad would grab me and, you know, give me a crack or something. So this guy, I guess Jimmy does something in the back of the car. The foster father tries to discipline him. And as he's doing it, he loses control of the car and basically is killed. Jimmy's unharmed in the back seat, but the father dies. His wife, who was Jimmy's foster mother, basically blamed Jimmy for the accident and basically severely beat him, sexually abused him, really just took it out on him. He was then subsequently sent right back to foster care. It wasn't until his early teens, basically a year or two after that, he finally gets adopted by the Burkes, a normal family. And he ultimately takes their name. They were so integral to his life. And this is where Jimmy really starts to find that family dynamic, that nuclear family. They were the only family he knew. And good on the Burks for basically rescuing him from probably, you know, the last couple of years before he got really old, where he may have done something even up before the connection to the mob. They lived down on Far Rockaway in Queens, and he spent a lot of that time in Calm. It was nice because they, you know, they celebrated his birthday and they had Christmases, and you know, up until, you know, really he went to prison, he would send them money. He would attempt to still take care of them after the fact. He really took to them, and they were the only family he knew, Blackjack. It was nice that it's always, I think, one of the nicest things you'll see is when a child gets parents. You know, there are a lot of really genuine moments on earth. That's one of the good ones. Every kid deserves a family.
Yeah. I mean, and especially, you know, these people, I mean, you talk about the night and day comparison. I mean, his foster father dies trying to hit him. And then his foster mother not only beats him, but sexually abuses him. I mean, you don't often hear of women sexually abusing boys. That's not the common theme there. These people were fucking monsters. Okay. And then think about it. You don't hear of a lot of families looking to adopt, you know, 14, 15 year old kids who have been abused. Like, that's not what people generally look to take in. So the Burke family, I mean, you go from a couple of monsters to a couple of fucking saints.
Yeah, no, you're so true. You're right. And, you know, by that time though, sadly, Jimmy was kind of damaged already. He was going to become a criminal. And, you know, it was basically said that around 16, he decided, this is what I want to do. I'm going to go into a life of crime, and, you know, I'm going to go the way of the streets. And, at basically 16, like many other mobsters, he meets an older guy in the neighborhood in Queens called Remo Sirisani. And basically they start doing capers together. They start coming up with schemes. Sirisani was kind of not a low-level associate, but he was at the time an associate in the Colombo crime family. He would eventually become a capo in the Colombo crime family. He was basically enacted as the mentor to Jimmy Burke. And they had some schemes where they were passing bad checks, this check scheme. Eventually, in 1949, at 18, Jimmy gets arrested, right? They pull him in. They try to get him to squeal on his contemporaries. He says no. He doesn't say a word. And this is an ode to the scene in Goodfellas when Henry Hill is arrested for selling cigarettes and he doesn't rat. Remember, Jimmy says to him, never rat on your friends and always keep your mouth shut. This is basically the story behind that. Jimmy doesn't squeal and basically, you know, gets Dom Sirisani out of it. And Jimmy ends up going to jail. He heads up to Auburn State Prison up in Northern New York and does his time. During his time in Auburn, he meets certain mobsters. He starts becoming connected. And, you know, I think the interesting thing about Jimmy by this point is, he's a big guy. He had a good camaraderie with the Italians, and he had connections. He was already involved with Remo Sirisani, and he had, you know, willingness to do things. And they liked that. By this point, Jimmy's big, as I said. I was 6'3", 230, real buff, big, burly guy. And he was an immense guy. A lot of people were terrified of him. So he gets out of prison, he comes home, and his foster father has a connection to the unions. They get him a job as a union bricklayer, and that's where he continues to really chisel his body, big arms. You know, weirdly enough, Blackjack, when I was a kid, I've told you before, my father's in the construction business, and when I was a kid, my dad was a concrete contractor, and I spent many summers, you know, pouring cement and, you know, carrying bricks and all sorts of stuff. So you can become in a summer or two, you can get jacked if you're out there. And Jimmy Burke by this point was, you know, almost pushing 250 pounds and most of it was muscle. And that's where his real connections start to happen. He meets Paul Vario. And if you've seen Goodfellas, he would be the Paul Cicero character. Mm-hmm. Paulie was really a do-it-all mobster. He was a capo in the Bonanno, the Lucchese crime family. and had a lot of connections to the union. He kind of got to like Jimmy, kind of understood that he made money, and he was willing to hurt people. He was like kind of an enforcer, if you will. He kind of stakes Jimmy. Jimmy goes and starts a loan sharking and bookmaking business right out of Ozone Park, Queens. If you know anything about Paul Vario, he ran out of Ozone Park. Now, remember, John Gotti ran out of Ozone Park as well. Bergen Hunt and Flish Club was in Ozone Park. You know, there are different neighborhoods, different, you know, groups and families kind of moved around in both of them. The good thing about Ozone Park is it's not too far from Kennedy Airport, and it was a great breeding ground for criminals.
Right. Aqueduct Racetrack also in Ozone
Park. Exactly. You know, Paul really got to like Jimmy as well because, as I said, he was gigantic. People didn't want to fuck with Jimmy Burke. No. It's pretty simple. You know, you don't want to mess with anyone that's big at the end of the day. But, you know, Henry Hill in his drunken stupors most of the time said a lot of dumb shit. But he had some pretty good quotes about Jimmy Burke. He said this one time about Jimmy. Jimmy was a big man and he knew how to handle himself. He looked like a fighter and a warrior. You could see it in his eyes. He was fearless when it came to fighting or killing people, and he was terrifying. He had an evil, ice-cold stare that could petrify any man, no matter where or who they were. If there were just the littlest amount of trouble, he'd be all over you in a second. He'd grab a guy's tie and slam his chin into the table before the, before the guy knew he was in a war, and he'd go to war with anybody. Basically, he was sadistic. So, you know, he was a cold and calculated guy, and not only was he powerful and rich, you know, but in the mob, Blackjack, there are two folks generally. There are killers and enforcers, and there are money people. And if you're a money guy, you're not generally going to kill people. Jimmy Burke was both of them, and that's what the mob loved about him. And they didn't care that he was Irish. He made money at the end of the day, and that's what mattered. And Paul loved him because Jimmy was making tons of money from his bookmaking and loan sharking business, and he was kicking it up to Paul and the Lucchese family. In 1962, basically at 31 years old, Jimmy meets a woman called Mickey Marin. He grows to really like her. They go out on some dates. And during this time, this is another inspiration to Goodfellas. If you remember, Henry Hill meets Karen. They go out on dates. And if you remember in the movie, she has that neighbor, Bruce, that's like bothering her.
Yep.
And Henry goes and like beats him basically with a gun. Yes. That actually really happened. Jimmy's wife, Mickey, who he ended up marrying, there was a neighbor that was an ex-boyfriend of hers. And he was giving Mickey issues. And you know, Jimmy basically attacked him at one point. They end up getting married. And right after they get married, Jimmy decides that, you know, he's had enough of this guy and he's going to go take care of him. So Jimmy goes, finds this guy, and basically begins with a chainsaw to cut parts of him up. And if you know, when you cut a chainsaw, pieces fall off, right?
Yeah,
so basically you're nicking somebody to death. And Jimmy Burke killed this guy with a chainsaw. The problem was, and this was the first real connection to murder Jimmy had. There was no proof of it, though. There was no evidence, and Jimmy never ended up being convicted, but this was one of the first murders that we know of that Jimmy committed. And remember, this was just a woman, you know, that he ended up marrying that somebody was messing with. So he takes care of them. Jimmy, and Mickey have, two daughters, and two sons. Weirdly enough, Jimmy Burke was obsessed with Jesse and Frank James, weirdly enough. The old outlaw brothers, and he named his sons Frank and Jesse, which kind of odd, Blackjack. But that was him.
It's a little bit of an odd association for a guy that's, you know, basically affiliated with the mafia. But, you know, I just think it kind of speaks to his thought process, right? I mean, Jesse James was, you know, the great, you know, train robbing bandit across the United States. And he's one of the most famous outlaws in American history. I mean, Jesse James and Billy the Kid are the stereotypical American outlaws. And I think that may be a little bit of insight into how, you know, Jimmy Burke viewed himself.
Yeah, he definitely liked the outlaw. He liked the bad guy. And if you remember in the movie, Henry Hill is quoted as saying that Jimmy was the kind of guy that rooted for the bad guys in the movies. That was an ode to the Jesse and Frank James connection. In the early 60s, Jimmy, again, was doing had a big loan sharking business. With the connection to Idlewild Airport at the time, which is now JFK, they were running out of a bar in Ozone Park. And, you know, Jimmy was really growing his business because he would have airport employees and people that would come in that, you know, needed loans. They needed to make bets. It was a perfect spot. And, you know, being that close, he started getting people that would become in debt to him. And what that turned to is this is where Jimmy's hijacking a career starts. He basically starts getting people that owe him money. You know, they aren't able to pay. And they say, well, look, I got an in at Idlewild and we can get you hijacking stuff. So they start hijacking, you know, anything that you could sell, whether it was clothes, whether it was shrimp, lobster, cigarettes, electronics, whatever they could find, they were selling and stealing and fencing. So by this point, this is when Jimmy meets Henry Hill and Tommy DeSimone. Now, the story about Tommy and Henry from the movies where they're selling cigarettes, that is true. But Jimmy didn't actually meet Henry until he was Henry was in his 20s. He was already involved. The story that Henry grew up around the mob is largely untrue, as far as I know. He didn't know Paul Verio when he was a kid. He didn't know Jimmy Burke when he was a kid. He didn't know Tommy until his late teenage years when he began selling cigarettes and moving around with mob guys. That's where Tommy and Henry meet, and they indeed then meet Jimmy Burke, who's basically creating a crew under Paul Verio. So there was a lot of basically connections, and there was a big tree involved with Paul Verio. Now, just a quick background on Tommy Blackjack. Tommy DeSimone, played by Joe Pesci in the movie, his father was very connected. His family was very connected. In fact, some of his uncles were big-time mobsters out in L.A. They were in the L.A. crime family. And weirdly enough, the shoe-shining stories about Tommy DeSimone were true. It was said one time when Tommy was young, he would never leave his house without his shoes shined. And he would basically was a legend in the mob community. He was basically shining shoes, and he shined them so nice you could shave off them, according to people. And that's where the "I don't shine shoes no more, Billy" came from. And it was discussed that in his previous life, when he was a kid, he did shine Billy Bat's shoes at one point. Tommy always had a chip on his shoulder, Blackjack, because his brother, Anthony, was an informant. And it was a real death nail to the family. Tommy really took it in jest. He was disgusted by it. And he had an axe to grind. He wanted to basically, you know, right the wrong and say, look, you know, I'm a real guy, real gangster, real mobster. I'm true Cosa Nostra. And he always had that chip on his shoulder because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Tommy DeSimone's a really interesting guy, and one day I'm sure we'll do one of these on him. But, you know, the one thing, too, that I think is interesting is that, you know, you watch the movie Goodfellas, and we see Joe Pesci play him, and you think, like, okay, because Joe Pesci is probably early 40s when that movie is made.
Yeah.
Tommy DeSimone, when he was killed, was, like, 28 years old.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he did a lot of stuff in a short amount of time. And his family is pretty interesting, too, because, like you said, you know, he's got the one brother who, you know, turned, and that was a problem. And then his sister, to kind of tie it all back, one of his sisters was Jimmy Burke's mistress.
Yeah, there was a lot of weird connections from a sexual standpoint with, which we'll get to in a little bit, with not only him, but Paul Verio, with all sorts of people. It was definitely some weird things going on with certain folks in that cohort. So basically these two young guys start running around with Jimmy and they form a crew. In 1967, this is where the big hijacking really starts. Jimmy basically realizes that the Air France terminal had become the carrier of American currency. So they would bring it from, you know, Asia and Europe, and the airline would basically you move the money into U.S. banks. And Jimmy finds out about this through a guy called Robert McMahon, who in the movie is called Frenchie, if you remember.
Yep.
he's in a couple movies, that actor. I don't know who it is exactly, but so basically he tips off Robert McMahon, Jimmy Burke, that there was a big time delivery of money coming in, basically an amount of like $400,000 to $700,000. So basically $500,000 in US currency. Now, remember, this is in 1967. That would be basically an equivalent to like $4 to $5 million.
Yep.
So this is a ton of money.
And it's not like some of the other heists, you know, where it's like you steal cigarettes or goods. This is straight cash. You walk out the building, it's yours.
Yeah. So on Friday, April 7th, they get this idea, 1967, that this is going to happen. Frenchie McMahon basically said that the best time for the actual robbery would be right around midnight. There was a security guard. He was an older guy. And they got to know this guy. And from what the different stories that have come out, I guess this guy would go on a meal break, and he was a bit of an old horn dog, if you will. So they basically set up a prostitute to basically lure him into a room of some sort and steal his keys, basically. So they go to do this, and they basically walk in and just basically grab the bag, and that's that. No one was injured, no alarm, no shots. And it was great because the discovery didn't happen until Monday, the following Monday. So they basically make off with a huge, huge score. And Jimmy, you know, obviously doles it out to the contemporaries. Paul Varia gets his cut. The Lucchese crime family gets their cut. The Bonanno crime family gets their cut. I believe they were partners as well at Idlewild. And everybody's making money. At that time, Jimmy buys Robert's Lounge, which is basically a quasi-social club bar that was in Ozone Park. It was really close to Kennedy Airport. And, you know, Jimmy's kind of creating a real money making opportunity. And it would just kind of start there. Jimmy also, Blackjack, one of the big rackets for mob families, especially in New York, in the hijacking business, was cigarettes.
Yep.
Cigarettes were, you know, a big money maker, because at this time in New York, the tax on cigarettes was one of the highest in the country. New York had this crusade against cigarettes, and they wanted to kind of limit them. So they made it hard to get them. Jimmy finds out that in, you know, southern states like North Carolina, you could go down there and buy a ton of cigarettes and basically take them back to New York and sell them for crazy profit margins. So they go down. Remo Sirisani's involved, his old mentor, and they start basically grabbing these cigarettes and taking them back to New York and flipping them. One time, a truck's coming back. Remo Sirisani gets arrested during this scheme. And if we remember back to Jimmy's childhood, he didn't cooperate against Remo. He saved Remo back in the day. Mm-hmm. The problem was Remo was not as strong an individual, and Remo Sirisani flips on Jimmy Burke. Jimmy finds out about it. They spot Remo at Robert's Lounge. Tommy DeSimone then lures him into a car, and they go for a ride, and Tommy strangles him with a piano wire. So that was that for Remo. And Remo had to go. He was a rat. He had basically, you know, I'm not saying that you should kill a guy, but you know, Remo deserved to die, Blackjack. He basically fucked Jimmy Burke.
I mean, dude, and if you think about it, like, this isn't a situation where you're staring down the barrel of a life sentence. Like, Jesus. Come on, man.
It was pretty – and again, I don't know all the charges they had on Remo. I mean, Remo by this point was a capo regime in the Colombo crime family. He was a big-time mobster. But again, as you said, I don't believe there are any murders involved here. And you know, Remo was a Cosa Nostra guy. To just flip over some cigarettes is crazy. So, yeah, you know, the cigarette thing was big business. But, you know, now they were killing people. And that's one – kind of common theme with Jimmy Burke. Jimmy Burke truly also, we talked about Tommy Patera last week. Jimmy was another one in belief that no body, no crime. You know, if you're going to drag, you're going to do something, you need to go. And Jimmy was a big eliminator. He eliminated people. If you had to go, you had to go. So Jimmy skates out. He doesn't get in trouble for that charge because there was no evidence again. And the only witness had died on their murder, on that murder. So Remo's dead and not going to testify. In 1971, this is where things start to get interesting for Jimmy Burke. You know, he's obviously he's become a big time mobster. He's moving around in a lot of different things. And one of the things he grabs is there was a gangster in the Gambino crime family called William Billy Bats Benvena. Benvena was a John Gotti loyalist. He was a friend of Gotti's, and he was a big time loan shark. Jimmy, while Benvena is locked up, basically takes over the loan shark business. And what Jimmy does basically is he pumps a ton into it. It becomes just a way better loan sharking organization than what Bats was doing. So basically the Gambinos kind of were just like, whatever, you're doing better than Bats. He's not around anyway. Salud. So in 1971, Billy Bats is released from prison. He comes home. At Robert's Lounge, like in the movie, they throw him a welcome home party. And remember, Roberts was owned by Burke. Henry Hill is stated as testifying that Hill stated that Benvena saw Tommy DeSimone and basically joked and said about him shining shoes, which we see in the movie. Yep. Tommy at this point has got a chip on his shoulder, like in the movie. And anything that was said in jest was taken literally. And Tommy was a sensitive guy. He basically takes as an insult. And DeSimone basically leans over to Burke and Hill and says, I'm going to kill that fuck. So he leaves. That's that. He didn't come back, you know, the next day or anything. 2 weeks later, on June 11th, 1970, Benvena is at the Suite, a nightclub owned by Henry Hill in Jamaica, Queens. And that night, Tommy basically comes in. He pistol whips Benvena, and they basically start beating him and kicking him. Benvena is taking it, and DeSimone basically yells to him, shine these fucking shoes, and just continues to beat him mercilessly. So they end up killing him, as the movie portrays. They place his body in the back of a car. They stop. That was a true story. They did stop at DeSimone's mother's to get a shovel and some lye. And they begin to hear sounds from the trunk, and they realize Benvena is still alive. They basically then go to the back of the trunk and beat him to death with a shovel and tire iron. They take him up to New York, upstate. Jimmy Burke had a friend that owned a dog kennel, and they bury him there. A couple of months later, Benvena has disappeared. Nobody knows where he is. John Gotti starts to get pissed off. This is John Gotti's guy, and he starts wondering. Burke finds out from the dog kennel owner that he sells the property to a housing developer, and they basically are ordered to go up and grab the body and put it somewhere else. Now, Henry Hill wrote a book, and for whether you believe Hill or not, I don't know that I believe him in this facet, but he basically said that they took the body and crushed it in a compactor at a junkyard. But in the movie, when they were doing commentary on the film, there was somebody that stated that Benvena's body was buried in the basement of Robert's Lounge.
Listen, I don't know what happened, but all I can say is, what could have been left of that body after being buried for 3 months in the open with nothing, with fucking lye put on top of it? Like,
yeah,
what could have been left?
Yeah, there probably wasn't much. And, you know, by this point, you know, John Gotti kind of plays it coy. He doesn't do much. He kind of suspected that Burke and DeSimone were behind it. Because if you remember, you know, Jimmy Burke had taken over some of Billy Bats's, you know, things. I mean, he was doing them, and the mob basically said, look, money's the obviously the purveyor here, and we're not going to worry that much about it. As we know, and we'll get into a little bit later, it does come back and bite the Jimmy Burke crew. In 1972, there was another incident involving Jimmy Burke and Henry Hill. Basically, they are down in Florida, down in Tampa. There was a guy called Gaspar Chiacchio. He was a guy that basically owed money to a union boss, Casey Rosado. He was a friend of Jimmy's from Florida. Chiacco owned owed a big debt to him and the guy wouldn't pay. So he sends Jimmy down and Henry down to Florida to basically deal with this guy. And as stated in the movie, I don't know if they threw him and tried to throw him in the lines. I think that was just for show. But Gaspar Ciocco's sister did work for the FBI, and she basically turned them in. And Jimmy and Henry basically get 10 years in federal prison. Jimmy goes to Atlanta. Henry goes to Lewisburg. At this point, Jimmy goes into Atlanta and he meets a guy called Paul Mazie. We'll talk about Mazie. Mazie was a mobster from Pittsburgh. And this is some of the things down the road that really start to unravel for Jimmy Burke. A lot of them come up because of Paul Mazie. Henry and Jimmy are both paroled, and they go into and back to Queens. In 1976, they get out of jail and head on home. And at this point, there's bigger fish to fry. Jimmy wants to start making more and more money. By this point, Jimmy is making a ton of money, but the problem, Blackjack, is from all intents and purposes, Jimmy's a big-time degenerate gambler. He's spending a ton of money. He's got high life habits, and he needs something or a multitude of different things that are going to be able to scratch that money itch. They're going to make him more money, big-time money. And this is where the two schemes come in that really start to make Jimmy a whole lot of money. In 1980, Jimmy is arrested. You'll ask why he was arrested. So while he was in prison, he meets this guy, Paul Mazie, a guy from Pittsburgh. He basically tells Jimmy that he has two players at Boston College University that are willing to shave points. Now, just a little bit of a primer for anyone who doesn't know what that means. That basically means that players on Boston College would know the point spread. They are willing to basically miss shots and do what they can to not cover the spread. And they had a scheme where they would identify what games they would be decent-sized favorites, 7 to 10 points in, and they would identify those games before the season and basically tell Jimmy and Henry, hey, look, we're going to basically win this game by 5 or 4.
Right.
And they start doling a ton of money out across the country to bookmakers. And this is where they involve Martin Krugman. Now, Martin Krugman was the Maury character in Goodfellas.
Correct.
Martin Krugman was a bookmaker and a scam artist, and he basically starts acting as a silent runner for these guys. They start putting in tons of bets throughout the course of the 1978-1979 season. Blackjack, it was estimated that Jimmy Burke made over $1 million on this Boston College point spread scheme.
It's an enormous amount of money, especially in that time frame. You know, to make on a college basketball point shaving scheme using Boston College, nonetheless. But I mean, as you said, there are certain things that will catch people's attention. And I think, you know, when you gave the Burke quote earlier about, you know, the money, it was always too much money and things like that. This is one of those things. You start messing with fixing sporting events, that'll catch people's attention real quick.
Yeah.
There's too many people involved. Let's be honest. There's just too many people involved to keep it quiet.
And that's what Jimmy realized. And he realized that it wasn't a long-term moneymaker. He made $1 million. That was that. The problem that Jimmy Burke really had his entire life was he was too greedy. And he was greedy to the point of he would pay, like he made $1 million through this scheme, the Boston College shaving scheme. Do you know how much he paid the athletes?
Very little would be mine.
$2,500 a game.
There you go.
I mean, and you know, when we get into Lufthansa, that was one of his issues there. And this Boston College scheme would kind of come back to haunt Jimmy down the road, because again, you know, the federal government, when you're dealing with kids in college and you know, scams and the mob, there's a lot going on. And there is a great ESPN 30 for 30 about this. Yep. Playing for the mob. It's very good. They interview, you know, all sorts of guys that were involved with this. Rick Kuhn was one of the guys involved, one of the players. You know, they try to get other guys to flip and do things and kind of back them down and scare them. And it's a really good documentary if you've never seen it. So they commit this scheme, and Jimmy realizes, as I said, that it's not a long-term way to make money. And Martin Krugman has a connection at the Lufthansa terminal at JFK. Krugman basically has a worker there called Lewis Werner that owed him $20,000. Werner was a degenerate gambler. Krugman was a bookmaker. And he owed him about 20 grand, which equivalent today is like 90 G's. So he owed him a lot of money. This guy was pretty much a big loser, because any gambler that works in an airport that wastes 90 grand is bad. So as usual, Lewis Werner figures out that there's a flaw in the Lufthansa cargo terminal and that he had information that would, quote, give them $1 million or more score. So Burke creates basically a task force, if you will, of his most trusted people to do this Lufthansa heist. It was basically Jimmy Burke, Tommy DeSimone, Angelo Seppe, Louis Cafura, Joe Manry, Paolo Lacastri, and Robert Frenchy McMahon. And if you watch the movie Goodfellas, there were several folks involved. Now, Burke's son, Frank Burke, would drive a backup vehicle, and then Parnell Stax Edwards would dispose of the vehicle. Now, Stax is in the movie as well. He's played by Samuel L. Jackson. Stax is an interesting guy. Stax Edwards was actually an associate of Tommy DeSimone. They were very close, weirdly enough. Stax was a black guy. He was a jazz musician, blues musician, and he would frequent and hang out at Robert's. Now, obviously, Blackjack, you know this. A lot of us know this. Most very small musicians don't make any money.
Nope.
And Stax was a big-time scam artist. He was doing a lot of credit card scams, and he would move stolen goods. And he was a good associate. He was a good moneymaker. He wasn't a high-level guy, but according to Paul Verrio, he was a master in credit card fraud. So, you know, Stax was a trusted guy. They involve him with this as well. And we'll get into kind of what goes down here. So on December 11, 1978, these guys basically robbed the Lufthansa heist at Kennedy Airport. And it was pretty simple. It was really kind of similar to the Air France robbery. It was estimated that the haul would be about $2 million. But in fact, the actual take of the robbery was almost $6 million, basically $5.875 million. Now, again, let's continue to talk about this. This is in 1978, okay? So that's a lot of money now, Blackjack.
Yep, sure is.
When you look at 1978, that's basically the equivalent of, I don't know, a lot.
I mean, it's a ton. I mean, depending on what you look at, people say it's about $23 million today, which is, I mean, at the time, it was the largest heist in American history, you know, up until I think there was a robbery in Los Angeles in the late 90s that topped it. But I mean, to walk out of there with $5.8 million and almost all of it in cash, by the way, is unbelievable. Like, it is, when they estimated two, when they finally counted this and figured out it was five, they had to be stunned.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you hit it on the head. I mean, 5 million of it was cash, basically, almost a million of it was in jewelry. This was a huge score. And at the time, it was the biggest cash robbery. Now, I don't know if this has ever been topped. I'd have to look into that. But it was quite the score. Now, this is where, again, Jimmy Burke, due to his greediness, really starts to hurt himself. It was said that Lewis Werner was to receive basically 10% of the take. And again, that would, you know, most of it would go to Martin Krugman, which he owed. And then Krugman would get a score as well for the finder fee. And each participant, Blackjack, because this is what Jimmy Burke did. He basically said, well, it's only going to be 2 million. And it ended up being six. And Jimmy ends up giving each participant between $10,000 and $50,000, which is wild. And this is the issue with Jimmy. He was greedy. I mean, he would never just kind of take care of people. He was always trying to skim people. People were getting sick of it. People were getting sick and tired of it. So what does Jimmy do? Jimmy basically says, fuck them. I'll just start killing them.
Yeah, and I think that that goes back to what you talked about before, where his philosophy was, you know, no body, no crime. Like, I think that when you're – that's why I say, like, they must have been shocked when they counted the money, because now all of a sudden this is, like, serious fucking money, right? Like, this is a ton of money. And you saw it in the movie where, you know, Jimmy Burke is telling everyone, don't go buying shit, right? Like, don't go spending money and being flashy. And, like, you know damn well there's going to be one or two that's going to go do something stupid. You know they are. And, like, if in his head he's probably thinking, you know what? It's going to be easier and cheaper to just get rid of them.
Yeah, and that's kind of what he did. And we'll kind of get into that systematically. One of the people that really fucks up during the Lufthansa heist is Stax Edwards. Stax basically had to hand the getaway van off to the Gambinos, and they would destroy it in a compactor. Stax basically, you know, instead of driving to New Jersey, goes into Queens and basically in front of a fire hydrant illegally, goes into his girlfriend's apartment and, you know, does what he does, and that's that. Police basically discover the van 2 days later, and they have Stax Edwards' fingerprints on them. Paul Varia finds out, Jimmy Burke find out, and they basically tell Tommy DeSimone, you got to go kill Stax. Now, again, remember, Stax trusts Tommy, their friends, and they, him and Angelo Seppe, basically find Stax Edwards at his house, who's in hiding at the time. I believe they live in, I lived in Harlem. They basically go in, he invites them in, turns his back, they shoot him five times in the head, and he's found in his bed dead. And it was weirdly enough said that Jimmy and Henry and Tommy all contacted Stack's family, talked about how sorry they were about it, and, you know, said their goodbyes. But yeah, so Jimmy starts kind of systematically taking care of people. Now, during all this, before we get into who he actually killed during this, there were some other things going on. If you remember in the movie, the character Spider, the Spider was actually a real person. His name was Michael Gianco. He was a server at a card game that they were having. And basically, as the movie portrays, they have an argument after Gianco forgets DeSimone's drink. DeSimone pulls out a gun and shoots him in the thigh. The kid comes back with a big cast on, like in the movie. And remember, he says, you know what, Spider, that bandage is bigger than your fucking head. They start to goad him about the leg. And basically, Gianco says, you know, fuck yourself, basically. Burke basically is impressed by it and kind of goats Tommy up a little bit. And that's where Tommy just pulls a gun out and shoots him three times in the chest. And angrily demands that, was that good enough for Burke? After he goats him,
Burke's furious. Tommy DeSimone did not have a sense of humor.
No, not at all. And Burke basically is furious and tells him that he needs to go bury the body and he's going to only do it himself. No one can help him. Henry Hill basically would say years later on the Howard Stern show that Michael Gianco, aka Spider, was buried next to Robert Lounge along with other bodies. So, you know, Tommy basically was the chief enforcer and killer for Jimmy Burke at this point. Jimmy wasn't necessarily getting his hands dirty, but they were taking care. He was taking care of the dirty work.
Yeah. Tommy DeSimone was a fucking lunatic. I mean, and by the way, excellent job by Joe Pesci.
Yes. Joe Pesci is terrific. Obviously, we know that. Obviously, probably his best role. He was very good as Russell Buffalino in The Irishman and some other films as well. But he also has a cameo in Bronx Tale. A lot of people don't realize at the end. But yes, a very good performance by Pesci. So at this point, Jimmy kind of sees the writing on the wall, and he starts systematically killing each of the people involved in the heist. I guess, Blackjack, it's a smart thing to do. I mean, A, you don't really have to pay them, and B, they can't really, you know, do anything that's going to hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think that the probably the primary motivator more than the money, because like you said, he was agreeing to pay them based off of the estimate not the actual heist. So, I mean, the money probably wasn't it. I just think that when you realize there's that much money floating around, like, you just can't have people being stupid. And
well, I think what really happened, here, Blackjack, is the associates started to really get pissed off at Burke and basically say, look, like, we're involved here. Why the fuck are we only getting this little amount?
And you're clearing like $4 million.
Yeah. And I think people were getting sick of it. They were pressuring him. So he first kills Stax. Stax is murdered. Louis Cafora, known as Fat Louie, and his newlywed wife, Joanna, were reported missing by their parents. They were never seen again. It was alleged, though, that Cafora was a rat and that Jimmy basically had to kill him and his wife as well. There was no car or anything, if you remember the movie. That didn't happen. Right. Frenchie McMahon and his close friend, Joe Manry, they were both found shot to death in a Buick parked on a Brooklyn street in 1979. Paolo Lacastri, who was in a Gambino family, he was involved and found shot to death in a garbage chute lot in Brooklyn. His body was on fire when they found it. And there were some other murders involved as well. A cosmetologist and cocaine dealer called Teresa Ferrara, who frequented Robert's Lounge and was a longtime mistress of not only Tommy DeSimone, but Paul Verrio. She was also killed in 1979 when it was discovered that she was a rat. Her dismembered torso was found in the Barnegat Inlet near Toms River, New Jersey. And it was assessed that she contacted the FBI fearing that she would be killed. Was also murdered.
You know what's interesting to me about this is that he made no effort to hide these killings. Like, they didn't bury these bodies. They didn't chop them up and, you know, toss them in the woods. These were all done in the open to be found. I think that's kind of strange, no?
Yeah, I'm not going to say that's not normal. I mean, it isn't normal. A lot of the time you'll bury them, but there's plenty of hits where they're just done out in the open. And I think it really depends on the time and when they were happening. You're not going to do that today or over the last 20 years. But, you know, back even in the 80s, that was done pretty freely. But you're right. It was done very...
Maybe he was doing it to send a message to the rest of the people involved. Like,
yeah.
If you fuck up, this is what's going to happen.
Yes, exactly. Now, one of the final people to be killed was, and I've said before, Maury in Goodfellas is one of the worst characters in mob history as far as movies are concerned. He's a real annoying character. Mm-hmm. But in real life, he was pretty annoying as well. It was said that he became just obsessive and annoying over the money that Jimmy owed him. Basically that, you know, Jimmy owed him 500 grand. He wanted to kind of move on with his life. And Henry Hill basically said it was a matter of $500,000. No way Jimmy was going to deny himself $500,000 because of Martin Krugman. If Jimmy killed Marty, Jimmy would get Marty's $500,000. So Jimmy killed him. And that was that. Jimmy was sick of hearing from him and just said, fuck him. He's gone. And they killed Martin Krugman as well. So Jimmy was systematically eliminating every person involved, separating himself from it. And it would indeed prove well, because at the end of the day, when Jimmy Burke down the road gets jammed up, you'll kind of figure that out. So by this point, you know, Jimmy's a rich man. He's made a ton of money. He's had a huge score. But that's not enough. Jimmy needs more. Jimmy basically starts working with a guy called Richard Eaton. Richard Eaton was a real scam artist, if you know anything about Richard Eaton, but he was also a drug dealer as well. And they basically start selling drugs. The problem was Richard Eaton in one of the drug situations basically sells them bullshit drugs. They're not real drugs. Jimmy becomes enraged and murders Richard Eaton. So this is really one of the last killings that Jimmy would be involved with. The problem with this murder and the other ones is there was some proof that Jimmy did it. I guess when they found Richard Eaton, when they found the strangled body in a lot, the body was so frozen. And this is an ode to the movie. If you remember the one character, the body was so frozen that it took days to thaw it out. And once they thawed the body out, they found a small little address book in the lining of Eaton's clothing with the name, address, and telephone number of one James Burke listed. So that obviously sets a big problem up. By this point, Henry Hill is a drug user. He's starting to get involved with his own product. He starts moving drugs with Paul Mazey. He gets jammed up, as we know. Henry Hill decides that he doesn't want to go to jail for 20 to life, and he starts informing. At this point, he basically tells authorities that DeSimone, or not DeSimone, that Burke, you know, he starts cooperating. During this time, though, and right before this time, Jimmy basically suspects that Henry is an informant and that he's doing stuff he shouldn't be doing. And if you remember Blackjack in the movie, they meet at that diner.
Yep.
And Jimmy kind of feels him out a little bit. By this point, DeSimone finds out that he's going to be made, and he's all excited about it. And he goes to the ceremony. As we know, though, at the ceremony, it doesn't last long. He's basically kidnapped and taken to the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club, where John Gotti exacts revenge. Their people kill Tommy DeSimone in the basement of the Bergen Club. And that was that. He had to go. He killed Billy Batts unsanctioned, and Billy was a made man, by Jack.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there are certain rules you just can't cross. And, you know, killing a made man when you're not – it's bad enough if you're one yourself. You still may be killed for it. But doing it when you're not is a pretty ballsy move. And, you know, like we said, Tommy DeSimone was like 28, 29 years old when he was killed. And, I mean, he did a lot in a short time frame. But by all accounts, Tommy DeSimone was just – I mean, it was a matter of time, Jeff, right? I mean, he was a goddamn lunatic.
Yeah. And yeah, he had to go. He was a psychopath. Again, by this point, 1980, Henry Hill's arrested for drug trafficking, becomes an FBI informant to avoid a long prison sentence, and goes into the witness protection program. Hill had been drawn into that cocaine business. And again, if you remember, the movie is pretty real in the fact that, you know, Paul Vario and a lot of other people told him not to go into the drug business, but Hill sets the network up and he's making too much money. Keep in mind, Lewis Werner, he also gets jammed up. And he's actually the only person to this day as far as Lufthansa heist. And I think up until recently, I think Vincent Asaro was involved. He got arrested, another mob guy. But Lewis Werner was one of the only people actually prosecuted for the case. Mm-hmm. But he becomes an informant after serving just 1 year in prison in the hopes that he'll get an early release. So Hill starts singing. Hill starts talking about Robert's Lounge. They get a search warrant. And, you know, he basically tells them about all the bodies, partially as a result of the testimony by not only Lewis Werner, but Henry Hill. On April 1st, 1980, Jimmy Burke is taken into custody on suspicion of a number of crimes. In 82, he's convicted in federal court of fixing Boston College basketball games as a part of that point shaving scheme in 1978 and gets 20 years in prison. Burke is said to have said, "I gave that little bastard Henry Hill some bucks to bet on games. That's all." Authorities knew that he had planned and organized the Lufthansa heist, but they didn't have enough evidence to actually prove it. And to the day that Jimmy Burke died, he was never convicted of the Lufthansa heist. That's one good thing about Jimmy. He was never really connected to much of anything outside of the basketball scheme and one murder. It was suspected that Jimmy committed more than 50 murders in his lifetime, but he actually was only convicted of one, which is a pretty big theme in mob culture. The only murder he was actually convicted of was Richard Eaton, the hustler and con man that schemed him out of things. And if you remember, they found his address on them. That was that for Jimmy Burke. The state case involved the murder, and he would later be charged with that murder based on more evidence that Henry Hill gave. At the trial, Hill took the stand and testified against his former friend, Jimmy Burke. And he also testified that Eaton had convinced Jimmy Burke to invest money in that cocaine deal that Eaton kind of screwed him out of. Basically, it's funny, too, because at one point, Hill asked Burke where Richard Eaton was. And Burke responds, "I whacked that fucking swindler out." He also told Henry that it would be a lesson to other drug purchasers who had not yet paid Burke. Based on all the evidence, Burke was convicted, and on February 19th, 1985, he was given a life sentence where he would serve in state prison. He also protested that that bastard died of hypothermia.
I love that.
When he was leaving New York on an airplane, he looked down at JFK and said to an officer, "Once upon a time, that was all mine." So he was a colorful guy, too. Now, there was attempts by Ed McDonald, who was the special assistant U.S. attorney. He did attempt to involve Jimmy in some other things, but the only murder that he ended up being convicted of was the Eaton murder. So, you know, it's interesting, Blackjack, because when you look back at Jimmy Burke, the two crimes that he was arrested for were mostly small portions of his life. They weren't huge moneymakers. I mean, the Boss College thing was, but you know, the big crimes, the heist, he was never actually convicted of.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting that they were able to get away with that when you consider not the heist itself, right? Like the heist itself is one thing, and it's obviously a huge, huge crime, but the amount of murder that happened after, like that they weren't able to tie any of this back to the Lufthansa heist is just incredible.
Yeah, but for Jimmy, it didn't last too long. Basically, Jimmy survived for about 10 years. He was up at Wendy Correctional Facility in New York City or New York State. He developed lung cancer. And on April 13th, 1996, at age 64, Jimmy Burke dies at the Roswell Park Center Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. Weirdly enough, had he lived, Jimmy Burke would have been eligible for parole in 2004. But it didn't matter because he died. Couple things about Jimmy Burke's family. Jimmy's son Frank actually was killed in 1987 while he was in prison. His son turned into quite a little criminal himself. He was a suspect in the Lufthansa heist, if you remember. He became basically a well-known heroin addict in mob circles and had been arrested many times for possession. He would move around at Robert's Lounge and you know, was messing around in mob circles. He was found shot to death in Cypress Hills, Brooklyn in 1987. And according to prison officials, there's no remorse or grief from Burke about the death of his son. I think he realized his son was his son and he was involved in the life. And Jimmy was a stone cold mob guy. At the end of the day, he knew that there were two ways out of the life. You die or you go to jail. That was it. His other son, Jesse James Burke, was not involved at all in organized crime. And from what's known, he's still alive. His daughter, Catherine, weirdly enough, Blackjack married Anthony Indelicato, which if that name's familiar to you, we talked about that last week in the Tommy Patera show. Anthony Indelicato was a murderer in his own right. And he was the protege of his father, Alphonse Indelicato, and was the mentor to Tommy Patera. So his daughter was involved with the mob per se. And as of the late 2000s, they still lived in the house that Burke owned in Howard Beach, Queens. So a lot of mob connections still for the Burke family. One thing we know about Jimmy Burke, Blackjack, he was a mobster through and through. He was never a made man. He could never be a made man. But I think we can agree that if he were an Italian, he probably could have been a boss, right?
I mean, I think that he certainly would have risen very quickly. I mean, he seemed to have a very keen sense on, we'll call it financial matters. I think he knew how to make money. He certainly wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty. But on the other side of that coin, he was also pretty smart about it, right? Because of everything you just said, like, you think about all of the things that he did, and they actually were only able to tie very little of it to him. So, yeah, I think that had he been an Italian guy, I think Jimmy Burke would have risen very, very quickly.
Yeah, you know, I think the sky would have been the limit for him. And it's weird because, you know, back then they obviously had a lot of rules. Now, today there are people that are not Italian that have been made. John Staff in Philadelphia made anybody. So you didn't have to be fully Italian. But back in those days, everybody had to be Italian. Now, a couple of other loose end tie-ups here. As we talked about, Tommy DeSimone died. Paul Vario died as well. He died in 1988 down at federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. He was imprisoned on racketeering and was doing a time also for extortion. And again, Henry Hill testified against him as well. He died of lung failure. Basically to this day, none of the involved people are alive. Henry Hill passed away as well. He actually died pretty recently. Henry Hill has turned into a bit of, he turned into a bit of a, you know, scumbag, really. I mean, he was always kind of a scumbag, but by the end of his life, he was a drunk. He was a drug addict. He had left the witness protection program and he was doing a lot of stuff in the entertainment world. He wrote a book. He was always on Howard Stern. I remember he'd always come at Howard Stern drunk out of his mind. He did some 60 Minutes stuff and he did consult as well on the Goodfellas movie and Playing for the Mob, the ESPN documentary. Henry Hill died in 2012 after a long battle with heart disease. He had been sick for a long time, according to his girlfriend, and his heart gave out. Again, he didn't die in prison, though, and he went out pretty peacefully, according to his longtime partner, Lisa Caserta. So there you go. Everyone is dead involved here, but I think the thing we can take out of the Jimmy Burke story is that he is the most successful non-Italian mobster, really outside of probably Meyer Lansky, several others. Obviously, Meyer would probably be
the... Yeah, I mean, Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, guys like that. But, I mean, in terms of, you know, the
present day.
Present day New York families, nobody touches Jimmy Burke.
No, no. And, again, not only was Jimmy Burke a money man, but he was a cold, calculated, callous individual. And we said before, at the end of the day, Jimmy Burke's downfall was not the fact that he loved money. Well, he did love money, and that was his downfall. But he was just greedy. I think if he would have just took care of people and wasn't so quick. I mean, at the end of the day, the problem was the Richard Eaton hit. It got dirty, and he got jammed up in it. He never showed evidence, and this was the one piece of evidence that they found. I'll leave Blackjack this. And I don't know if this has ever been proven, but there was a rumor that when Jimmy was in jail in 1990, he found out about Goodfellas and that Robert De Niro was going to play him in the movie. And that, according to prison officials, he was ecstatic about it. And there was a rumor that he actually called De Niro and gave him a couple of pointers. Keep in mind, though, years later, screenwriter Nick Pileggi would deny it, saying that De Niro and Burke had never spoken. But there were men around the set all the time that had known all the principal characters. So, you know, all in all, I'm sure Jimmy knew about it, and Jimmy seemed pretty proud of it.
I mean, listen, if you're going to have someone play in a movie, Bobby De Niro is not the worst choice in the world.
Yeah, right? Probably the one you want most, right?
Yeah, I mean, Robert De Niro is about as good as it gets. So, yeah, I'd imagine he was pleased with that. And listen, I think De Niro played him perfectly. So
what we'll remember from him is Jimmy Burke was really everything that he had wanted to be, but he's everything that we thought he would be. Jimmy Burke had no shot to succeed. Jimmy Burke, from the age of two, was abandoned. Jimmy Burke never had a family, really, outside of a couple caring people from Queens. And Jimmy Burke was made into a sociopathic gangster, basically, at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I forget who it was in one of our episodes that we were talking about Horatio Alger stories.
Yeah.
Jimmy Burke is a Horatio Alger story, right? Like, he is a kid who came up with one of the worst possible childhoods you can imagine and made a life for himself. And granted, it's not to say that he made a great life for himself, because he certainly killed a lot of people, and that's not a good thing. But I think that he made the best out of what he was dealt, because that kid, with the childhood we discussed, man, there's no path for that kid to be a normal, productive member of society. There just isn't. So I think he, you know, to borrow the phrase, I think he kind of made chicken salad out of chicken shit to a certain degree.
Yeah, I guess all in all, in terms of success, he did make a ton of money, but you know, he did it the wrong way. And again, he had no real shot to ever succeed. So that's that. Jimmy Burke, our first non-Italian, or really outside of the Black Mafia, But you know, Jimmy Burke was one we had to do. The Goodfellas story we had to do. Maybe we'll do a Tommy DeSimone story down the road. Next week we will do Joe Mussino, though. I watch Goodfellas last week and I thought, you know what, let's just do Jimmy Burke. People I think will like this show. Maybe they'll learn something they didn't know. And yes, we'll do Joe Mussino next week. Probably going to do Al Capone here soon. We'll do Lucky Luciano here soon. I do want to do Kabani Savage. She's a drug dealer I want to get to. All sorts of guys to still do. All people to still do. If you ever have someone you want us to take a look at, make sure you reach out. I do want to do Merit Bagula. He was a Russian mobster. All sorts of guys. So
yeah, I love the Vegas guys. You know, like we talked about Meyer Lansky.
Yep, we got to do Meyer. We got to do
Benny Binion is another fascinating guy. Like there's a lot of guys that are.
You know, Tony Spilatro, guy from Chicago, to do him.
Guys that were instrumental in the building of Las Vegas.
Sure, 100%. Carmine Persico, we need to do the Snake. We got a lot of ones to do. So if you ever have someone you want us to talk about, just reach out. We'll get to them. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks for checking out the show. I know we have a little bit of a cult following. We thank you for checking it out. And if you enjoy it, make sure you subscribe and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think of it. Joe Mussino next week. But this has been Jimmy Burke. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down. Have a great night. I'm Jeff Nadeau. He's Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you later.